and welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today is the show for August 10th of 2011. We're going to be playing a series of interviews that we conducted earlier this month with our in-house economist, Suhava, from down in Mexico, asking him about some of the current politics of the debt debate and things like that. And then he's going to be helping us in an interview with world-famous economist Hernando de Soto. So please stick around. The first question that we're going to be asking is to Suhava. And, Hava, what do you think about this whole idea of if the U.S. defaults, there will be catastrophic situations?
It's obviously not the end of the world. I mean, I think it would be much more, I would say, dangerous for the world if Greece does default than the U.S. Because it's really not that the U.S. is going to default. It's simply that they will have to basically stop covering some of its current expenditures. And that may actually generate some downgrade in the investment grade of the U.S. So usually, what happens when these type of events happen at any level? No, if you lose part of your grade, meaning you are more risky, then you, as a holder of that type of assets, in this case, treasury bills or bonds in general from the American government. Since they become in paper more risky, then the financial institutions who actually hold them, they have to have more provisions against potential losses of them because they became more risky, right? So then what actually may happen is that when people when banking institutions actually had to provision more capital for holding those assets, that may create some kind of credit crunch. I don't know if to call it a crunch, but it certainly would create some kind of shortage of credit, in the sense that some banking institutions, not necessarily only in the U.S., but also in some other countries, that would be lending now would be basically provisioning. Right, so that's basically what I think it would happen. But regardless of the U.S. losing a little bit of their grades, the fact is that people need what they call safe havens. Institutional investors need hard currencies, and no matter how much you dunk, well, maybe I'm exaggerating, but it really doesn't matter if you lose a little bit of the grade. The fact is, people still are happy holding U.S. Treasury bonds, and they'll keep holding them. So, it's really not that catastrophic at all, I would say. And this is more, I guess, reflecting, this big, big political fight in the U.S. and obviously, trying to make Obama look like a fool and incapable of dealing with these very important issues. I feel it's not an economic problem, but rather a political one. It may have some non-negligible economic consequences, but I think this is more a reflect of a political problem.
Do you think that, let me ask you one more question. Do you think that there's a lot of warnings from people on the right that if we continue with these deficits, there's just going to be massive amounts of inflation? And
right.
And the Federal Reserve is causing, in the long run, just flooding the market with money, with quantitative easing and whatever's happening, buying so many bonds, it will in the long run create much worse inflation than they think. Do you think that there's any merit to that argument?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, basically we know that monetary policy works well in combination with good fiscal policy, right? I mean, and the fact is that in the crisis, basically the Federal Reserve didn't have any other choice but actually, get into the market and buy these huge amount of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities and so on, that up to now they've been able to control pretty well, I would say. I mean, they have some tools at their disposal that allow them to keep, inflation under control, despite the fact that they incurring what is called quasi-fiscal operations, right? I mean, basically the operations that they carried out during the crisis could have also been carried out by the Congress. But the thing is, had the Congress acted in that way, perhaps they needed authorization from it would have been politically more difficult to pass it that way rather than the Fed did it directly, right? So the point is now the Fed has a lot of assets. If the situation does not evolve in a, I would say, fiscal sustainable or sound environment, there is a higher chance that the what is called the exit strategy in the U.S. is not as easy or as riskless as some people think it would be. So obviously there's some danger of having some inflation in the future. I think at the moment is not a real problem. I mean, I don't think it really has a very high probability yet. But obviously, if the fiscal situation does not get fixed, eventually it could be a problem, right? A big problem. And the fact is, once you go from a low inflation environment to a higher inflation environment, people start developing expectations that in the future prices will be higher and so on. So you may end up actually having some situation in which you experience high inflation. I mean, not you would experience hyperinflation, right? Like crazy inflation, but you could experience high inflation and low growth, and that's basically what the U.S. needs to avoid at all costs. And one of the ways to fixing up the structure of the economy is basically getting back into a balanced path and a sustainable debt. That's my view.
You are listening to the Logic Consortium here on WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance. And that was a couple questions we did with our in-house economist, Danielle Sujava, from down in Mexico. And he's going to be helping us now interview world-famous economist, Hernando de Soto. We spoke with Mr. de Soto about 2 years ago on this program about his groundbreaking book, The Mystery of Capital. It's really changed the landscape about how people view how countries develop economically. Basically, he says that there needs to be a good information property system so people know who owns what and that people can get mortgages against those properties to start businesses and things like that. So this is his basic argument, or one of them, and we're going to be asking about those, and Suhava is going to be asking about some other things. So please stick around for our conversation with Hernando de Soto. Mr. de Soto, can you tell us currently where the debates are at about property in the U.S. and in the rest of the world?
Well, what I know about the United States, of course, is that you are a country where there are rights to have property rights. In other words, it is clearly established that everybody has a right to the law that governs property. And so your controversies in North America relate to just how much ties, how much conditions there are to the way you have property, how much eminent domain, how much of it you may be actually communal, what are the obstacles that come with it, etc. In the rest of the world, the arguments go in different directions. They go, especially, I would say, in the direction of whether there is a right to a property right. What I mean by that is that they are still at the stage of finding out whether people or how people are going to be awarded a property right, because they have really none except the right to possess something. But it is much more one of natural law or one of customary law. It is not one that is shielded by the law itself. You can take the case, if you want to, of the Arab Spring. You know that since about now 7 months, the Middle East is in huge turmoil. and that there have been manifestations of people on the streets toppling governments all the way from Morocco to Syria. Already President Mubarak has been toppled in Egypt. President Ben Ali has been toppled in Tunisia. And this all starts with a street vendor who on the 17th of December of 2010, the street number go the street vendor goes by the name of Mohamed Bouazizi, immolates himself in a public square, and that sets off the revolution in all these countries, which are very different countries. Egypt is nowhere anything like Libya, etc., but all over the place. Well, we've been doing some research on that, and what's interesting is that once this man immolates himself, in about 2 months, this is followed by also informal, or let's say, businessmen who don't have property rights but possess things, also immolating themselves alive and dying all over the Middle East, to the tune of 39 of them. Also from Syria to Jordan to Yemen to Egypt to Algeria. I think there's about 17 in Algeria who immolated themselves. Now, here's the part that's interesting. The question is, why did Bouazizi immolate himself? So I've just been to Tunisia to find that out because I thought I could get a glimpse of the truth. And the fact is, because all the things that he owned that were not protected by legal property law were expropriated from him by the state. And in protest, because the expropriation was enough to actually bankrupt him for all practical purposes, he set himself on fire, and that's what got this wave of protests going around the West, going around the East. So the fights for property rights are different where you go. In the case of the Middle East, it's because they don't have the right to a property right, and in your case, it's because you have property rights, but you want to exercise them in a different way.
Mr. Soto, this, my question is more about to what extent, for instance, the importance of emerging economies and their prospects for growth, and also, you know, for instance, in particular, I don't know, China and Brazil, that may not have that well or that developed property rights. To what extent these economies may pose a challenge to your theory?
Sure. Well, if you take the case of China, just about everything that you actually buy from China that exports has one form of a property right, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to export, because you've got to fill in a bill of lading. A bill of lading is a document you fill, which we know in Latin America as un conocimiento de embarque. You know, it's how you embark your goods. And first, the first thing you've got to write in, like for a passport, is who's exporting and who owns it, and you got to prove you own it. Otherwise, it would be stolen goods. So there's no way that China's exports don't have property rights. They do have property rights. It is figured by those who study China that the amount of normal men in the streets, people that have already got property rights, are somewhere in the tune of about 400 million when you've got a population of about 1,300,000,000. So a little bit less than half of Chinese already have property rights. There's areas where these things are being fought out, which is in the countryside, where the government doesn't actually give you a fee simple property right the way they would, say, in the United States. Fee simple being that you have a right, and it's for all practical purpose for eternity, unless, of course, there's eminent domain. In the case of China, these would be about 30 years. In other words, they follow the British system of property rights, which is that many property rights are not fee simple, that is to say forever, but they take the form of what they call a lease, which is you've got it for 900 years or you got it for 70 years. So the Chinese don't have permanent property rights, but they do have property rights. And in the countryside, it's still a toss-up of whether they're going to get it or they're not going to get it. I understand for two reasons. One is that part of the Communist Party of China believes that property rights, of course, in the Marxist tradition, taint people, put the worst of incentives on them. And the other side is because, of course, much of what farmers have today, some would wish going for industrial purposes. But China is on its way to property rights. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to have the success that they have today.
Right. Thank you. This answer obviously means that an important part of the success that China is having or may have in the next years, obviously, is very linked, very tightly connected to the development in their property rights system. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct, because there is no way. You see, at the end, all prosperity, whether you read Adam Smith or you read Karl Marx, is the result of what the traditional economists call the division of labor, which is basically that everybody specializes in one thing or another. And then, of course, somebody brings all these different things together. So a locomotive has got 5,000 parts. So whoever puts a locomotive together may have, for all I know, 1,000 suppliers or 80 suppliers. I think the other day we were trying to find out how many parts there were in a BlackBerry, and there's something like 400 parts. So BlackBerry has to put 400 parts together. That's the division of labor. Now, if you do not have a clear definition of who owns which part, so that there's a sales contract so that whoever puts all these parts together to make a BlackBerry, to make a locomotive, or to make an automobile, you can't have the division of labor, because you don't know who you're buying from or you're going to get a steady supply, and you can't pass bills. So there is no way China's going to get ahead without property rights. The issue here is just how efficient the property rights law is, how protected it is from politics, and the other part is whether they're going to be able to actually get people interested in making big investments if the property rights are only given for a duration of 70 years while awaiting renewal. Those would be the issues, but that they've got property rights, they've understood that very well. The question is whether they want to give it to the farmers and how much time they want to give it for.
You are listening to the Logic Consortium here on WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, in our conversation with economist Hernando de Soto. Thanks so much for listening.
Mr. De Soto, in the book The Other Path, you spend a lot of time discussing mercantilist economies, characterizing them as a mixture between cronyism, bribery, and bureaucracies that serve the ends of the privileged classes. And as you mentioned, when economies are run by politics rather than markets, this really creates a harmful situation. And as you just mentioned, this paradigm has proven very prescient with the Arab Spring. Can you talk a little bit more about this and what governments have to do to fight against mercantilism? And is this type of inevitable with a big government bureaucracy? You mentioned that bureaucracies become corrupt with money to administer, and even in the U.S. there are mercantilist tendencies with all the lobbying and the influence in Washington leading to so much subsidies and things of the sort.
Well, you're absolutely right when you say that mercantilism basically is something that doesn't just pass and go away, because as long as there's government and there are people who work in the private sector looking for privilege, and it's logical that people should want privileges. I mean, even queuing up to get a movie ticket, you try and find a way of not doing that queuing up. So there is a tendency towards mercantilism, that is to say the use of state favors in every country. What you can do is, of course, reduce it very much, which happens in places like the United States and Western Europe versus parts of the world like where I live or in the Arab Spring. So you've probably had that mercantilism in all the world for many years, in the sense that there's always been a private sector, but it's a private sector that has very particular non-competitive relationships to the state. This is what happened early on when to do business, for example, in what is today the United Kingdom, you had the right to do foreign business, but then you had to have a charter with the king, and then it was decided how much the king or the kingdom got and how much you had. And once you had the Silk Route, or you had a special trade with India, you had privileges and you were covered against competition. So private sector without competition is an old way of organizing things. What's interesting about the free market, of course, is that it at least in principle, does not accept that there should be privileges. Everybody has got to be has got to compete, and what counts are prices and the quality of the services, and that's what actually keeps keeps in place. So, in places now that like Arab countries, they're going to have to open up the market. Now, many Arabs will probably say, but boy, that's exactly what we were doing before. But the problem then is, yes, they were opening it up, but they were opening it up among those who are already within the law. As I mentioned before, those who have rights to property rights. But there's still, according to my numbers, a good amount of Middle Eastern people, up to even 60% of the population, if not more, who are just can't get inside the legal system so as to be awarded a competitive property right and be able to get into the market. I mentioned the case of Mohammed Bouazizi, who was a street vendor. He had no way of getting in. I mean, we checked, for example, if to be a street vendor there was a legal procedure for which you had to apply, and we found out that there was one. And when we asked his parents why he didn't apply, he said, yes, they did. And when we then went to the recording office and tried to find out, among other street vendors, who had managed to get the authorization to sell, we found out that it was inapplicable. In other words, in the law, it said that there was a procedure. In practice, there wasn't. In the whole city of Sidi Bouzid, where Mohammed lived, there wasn't one street vendor who had managed to get that authorization. In Egypt, to be able to get, in average, to get an authorization to build on a sand dune, since it's very hard or it's more expensive and it's even against the law to build on agricultural land, can take you up to 17 years. In the case of Lima, Peru, it used to take 21 years. In the case of Manila, at least 10 years ago, it used to take 25 years. So, in other words, what you've got is that one thing is saying in the law that you actually can compete with everybody, and another thing is actually being able to go through the red tape with sufficient ease to be able to enter the market. And what happens in many of these developing countries is that procedures and controls are just simply not sophisticated enough to let everybody in. So what the Arab states are going to have to do, according to me, is not only make sure that on paper everybody can get in, but you're going to have to check it on the ground where even the poorest person can get in. Just one last example. We actually did the simulation of what it takes to open a bakery in Tanta, Egypt. So a bakery is a very simple operation. Bread is an absolutely basic staple of the Egyptian diet. And it took us 544 days. 544 days working 8 hours a day to go through the red tape, and that's only the right to open the bakery. Apart from that, you've got to stay within the law and comply with day-to-day requirements. And apart from that, should you decide that you don't want to have a bakery anymore that does, I don't know, white and black bread, you also want to do chocolate cakes, then you've got still other procedures. So these are all countries that have private enterprise, but whose free markets are extremely restricted, either because this is an unconscious process or because people haven't understood that freedom is not that easy to get. You have to create the sort of railways whereby the train of the free market can ride.
Chava, do you have time for one more question, Mr.
Yes,
Soda?
Absolutely.
Chava, would you like to finish up or?
No. Yes. Thanks to Mr. DeSoto, and you take it, Jake, please.
Okay. There's one thing that you mentioned in the book is that the traditional left, in the other path, you say some people on the traditional left confuse the two systems of the market economy and the mercantilist system, not understanding that what we have in many cases is a mercantilist system. And when they blame, the blame goes around, and they blame the lack of success on capitalism, when the real problem is mercantilism. So should arguments be more focused against the corruption rather than sometimes people misdirecting the argument towards a liberalism or capitalism that leaves people behind?
I think that this is a very important. This is a very important point, because all of us who sympathize and fight for free markets. I'm certainly on that side of the game. We have a tendency to believe that it's enough if the law simply says that you can go into business, that it's a free market. But it's like a football game, or it's like any game in the world. You require very precise rules, and you require sanctions, and you require umpires. You need to make sure that the rules are always done in such a way that they keep the market free and open. And this applies, as you were saying before, not only to Arab countries, developing countries, or the former Soviet Union. It also applies in the United States. For example, in the United States, if you own a building, if you own an automobile, if you own an airplane, whatever you own, there's a record that says what it is that you own. The advantage of that is that it simplifies taxes, of course. It also makes sure that you're not buying somebody else's property. You're buying the right kind of person's property. It gives it all the fungibility that is needed for it to develop. But there are areas where you do not really have easy records, and they tend to get out of whack. In other words, they tend to be get outdated. To give you an idea, part of it could be these financial statements. In the old days, when you asked a bank for its books, you'd have one set of books, and so you knew whether the bank was in business, not in business, insolvent, what's the outstanding debt, and you knew what kind of a risk you were taking. And therefore, competition worked because you were able to compare one bank's, you could compare one bank or one large corporation's set of books to another one. But, for example, now when Enron broke up, they found out that they had about 3,500 different books. So it's gotten to a point where you may have a free market in certain senses, but to figure out who's doing what and where and to make them compete just gets harder and harder. Or you've now got these financial derivatives, which are basically private paper on which you create private credit to be able to fund activities from subprime markets to ordinary trading deals. And these derivatives are not recorded anywhere. As a matter of fact, some of the Dodd-Frank bill is trying to create at least a clearinghouse, but you've got over $700 trillion of these derivatives without any place where they're recorded so that you can actually know who you're dealing with and who's actually making the deal with you so that you can avoid a major disruption. In other words, what I'm trying to say by all of this is that keeping in place a competitive system is not an easy task. It does require rules. It requires very precise rules because we get more sophisticated all the time. We invent different things, and it requires information, as much clarity of information as possible. And that's why we all have a tendency to, without wanting to necessarily, but to create privileged markets where nobody knows what's going on except a few insiders. And that conspires against the free market.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium. This is the music of Matt Hudson and Scientific Map. And that was our conversation with Hernando de Soto, the proven economist, talking about property rights, talking about other types of things. And we talked about on the last program that it's not a libertarian agenda, it's a universal agenda. You can find our other interview with Hernando de Soto at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. And you can find other interviews that we're trying to put together. So thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.